ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And this week, I'll be joined by blogger Rick Aragon talking about Ben-Hur, both the 1959 Charlton Heston version and the recent 2016 remake, as well as various other Hurs in between. So let's hear a little bit from Ben-Hur.
You may conquer the land. You may slaughter the people. That is not the end. We will rise again. The day Rome falls, there will be a shout of freedom such as the world has never heard before. Me and your mother and sister will die today.
Oh, Judah!
May God grant me vengeance. I don't believe in miracles.
No, life is a miracle.
I should kiss you goodbye.
Oh, Judah!
We're praying for a man who can drive their team to victory over Messala. You could be that man.
This is the day.
Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ, was originally written by author Lew Wallace in 1880. Divided into 8 books, the story follows the fictional Judean prince Judah Ben-Hur, who is falsely accused of assassinating a Roman governor and enslaved by his childhood friend Messala, a Roman officer. Judah is sent to the belly of a slave ship for life, while his sister and mother are imprisoned in a Roman jail. Judah is eventually adopted by the captain of the ship, returning to Rome where he trains as a soldier and charioteer, all with an eye towards seeking revenge against Messala and Rome.
People of Jerusalem, friends of Rome, we celebrate the power of man. You will see them raise for glory. You will see them fight for honor. You will see them die for you.
Should have stayed away.
You should have killed me.
I will.
Now, Ben-Hur isn't just all about chariots and revenge. In the book, throughout the narrative, Judah encounters Jesus Christ working his way through Jerusalem. Bearing witness to Christ's crucifixion inspires Judah to put his revenge aside, where he becomes a Christian and decides to build the Catacomb of San Calixto in Rome for Christian martyrs. Ben-Hur actually became the best-selling book of the time, surpassing Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. It remained a bestseller until 1936, when it was dethroned by a little-known author named Margaret Mitchell and her novel Gone with the Wind. You might have heard of it. Now, Ben-Hur has been adapted for practically every medium, from stage to radio and, yes, film. To keep things on a brisk clip, let's strictly look at the filmed adaptations of Ben-Hur.
Would I retain your friendship if I became an informant?
To tell me the names of criminals is hardly informing.
They're not criminals, Messala, they're patriots.
Patriots!
Like
patriots! Judah, let me explain something to you. Something you may not know. The Emperor is watching us. At this moment, he watches the East. This is my great opportunity, Judah, and yours too. If I can bring order into Judea, I can have any post I want, and you'll rise with me, I promise. And do you know where it can end? Rome! Yes, perhaps at the side of Caesar himself. I mean it. It can happen, and this is the moment, Judah, I swear, this is the time. The Emperor is watching us, judging us. All I need do is serve him. And all you need do is help me. Serve him.
You speak as if he were God.
He is God, the only God. He is power, real power on earth. Not.
I would do anything for you, Messala. Except betray my own people.
The first filmed adaptation of Wallace's novel was a 15-minute silent short in 1907, credited to Sidney Olcott, Frank Oakes Rose, and H. Temple. Being less than 20 minutes obviously prevented the full story from being told, and it's no surprise the main focus is the chariot race, filmed in a lovely Roman place called New Jersey. William S. Hart plays Messala, reprising his role from the 1899 stage production. This first film's legacy is actually more as a lesson in copyright law, because it was made without the estate of Lew Wallace's permission, which was common practice at the time. The book's publisher decided to sue the studio for copyright infringement. The U.S. Supreme Court sided with the publishers, and thus all film studios now secure permission before adapting any published work. 17 years ended up passing before the next version, which was actually the first feature-length adaptation of Ben-Hur, debuted, with permission from the estate, of course. 1925's Ben-Hur starred Ramon Navarro, with direction by Fred Niblo. The production was fraught with difficulties, taking 2 years to film and costing $3.9 million, making it one of the most expensive films in the silent era. The chariot race here is considered the best, and this was one of the rare uses of two-strip Technicolor, which was utilized when Jesus arrives. Despite a massive marketing campaign and strong audience reaction, the expansive budget actually made this a loss for MGM at the time, but it secured additional revenue when it was re-released in 1931.
What service have you seen? 41.
A month less a day in this ship.
You keep an exact account. And before?
3 years in other ships.
3 years? You have the spirit to fight back, but the good sense to control it. Your eyes are full of hate, 41. That's good. Hate keeps a man alive. It gives him strength. Now listen to me, all of you. You are all condemned men. We keep you alive to serve this ship. So row well and live.
After 34 years, Hollywood was ready to ride with Ben-Hur again, with what's probably the one best known by the masses. Fresh off of directing Gregory Peck in The Big Country, director William Wyler, who had previously directed Wuthering Heights and Jezebel, was tasked with directing off of a script credited to Carl Tunberg, but which actually received contributions from the likes of Maxwell Anderson and Gore Vidal. This version of Ben-Hur had the largest budget up to that point, at $15.75 million, as well as the largest sets constructed at Cinecittà Studios. Wyler wanted to show the divide between the Romans and the Jews, so he cast American actors as the latter and English actors in the former, which dates the picture about as well as you'd expect. Burt Lancaster, Paul Newman, Marlon Brando all turned down the role of Judah, leaving my favorite actor, Charlton Heston, to play the Judean prince. Thankfully, he keeps his clothes on in this film for the most part. Filming took 8 months, with the crew working 12 to 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. The 9-minute chariot race dominates the film's second half, and despite the rumors, no one was actually killed during the filming. With nearly $15 million spent marketing, Ben-Hur premiered in November of 1959, making it both the fastest and highest-grossing film of the year, and it was the second highest-grossing film in history at the time after, once again, Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. Critics were generally ecstatic, and the film went on to secure a record 11 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Charlton Heston. The general plot of the film actually remains consistent throughout all these adaptations, but the 1959 film was the first to have a little bit of a slant to it, both politically and through the characters. Narratively, the political disagreements between Judah and Messala contain connections to the recently ended McCarthy hearings. This one also has, by far, the strongest, shall we say, romantic interactions between Messala and Heston.
Ben-Hur and Messala, one Jewish, one Roman, had known each other in youth. They disagree over politics, and now they hate each other for the next 3 hours. Well, that isn't much to put a whole three-hour movie on, even something as gorgeously junky as Ben-Hur. The director of the movie, William Wyler, said, what do you do? And I said, well, look, let me try something. Let's say that these two guys, when they were 15, 16, when they last saw each other, they had been lovers, and now they're meeting again, and the Roman wants to start it up. Messala, played by Stephen Boyd, wants to start it up again with Ben-Hur, played by Charlton Heston, heaven knows why, but he does. Anyway, he's Roman. So, Willie stared at me, face gray. And I said, well, I'll never use the word. There'll be nothing overt. But it'll be perfectly clear that Messala is in love with Ben-Hur. Willie said, Gore, this is Ben-Hur. A Tale of the Christ, I think, is the subtitle, he said, rather vaguely looking around. And Willie finally said, well, it's certainly better than what we've got. We'll try it.
With the longest gap preceding any of the previous versions, nearly 60 years separates last weekend's Ben-Hur from the last 59 cut of the movie. Though the new remake touts itself as having stronger connections to the book, the plot is pretty indistinguishable from the Charlton Heston version. Directed by Timur Bekmambetov and written by Keith Clark and John Ridley, this Ben-Hur drops the Tale of the Christ subtitle, despite being funded by Christian producers Roma Downey and Mark Burnett. The film stars Jack Huston, grandson of director John Huston, as Ben-Hur and Toby Kebbell as Missala. After a production fraught with difficulties on par with the 25 rendition, negative buzz is brimming on this one, with it being considered one of the biggest flops for Paramount Studios. So the question, I guess, is left. Has Ben-Hur finally won the race, or have we all lost? Whew, we've already gone through so much history, and we've gone through this history twice, actually, because if you're listening to this episode, we recorded this a week ago, and it disappeared into the ether, which is why you fine folks got to listen to my interviews a week early, because I had to put them in lieu of the original episode. But I am back talking with Rick Aragon about Ben-Hur. Rick, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
With the All Life Film Critics Society for about 5 years. I've been reviewing for a little over. I've been passionate about film. I've also taken some film classes when I was at the University of Texas at El Paso. I work at the public library, and it's been one of the great joys of my life to both work at the library and talk about film. And
well, what's your backstory in history with Ben-Hur? Which version did you see first, and which ones have you seen since?
The first version I saw was the 1959 version with Charlton Heston, Stephen Boyd, decades ago. After that, I've seen every version of Ben-Hur. There is a 1925 silent version that's included is another disc on the, I think, 5-disc Ben-Hur DVD set. There's also a 2003 animated version. There is a 2010 miniseries. And then there is this one, the most recent version of Ben-Hur. So I have seen every version, not in strict chronological order, just starting with Heston and kind of, I guess, working my way backwards. Or forwards, sorry, forwards.
By that same token, I am working backwards, because the first version of this that I saw is the 2016 version that just came out about a couple weeks ago. This was the 59 version that we're also talking about today is the second one I saw, so I'm going backwards in time. They both have pros and cons, I think, which we're going to deconstruct in a second. Definitely the 59 version, I think we both agree, is the better film.
Yes. Amen to that.
So we're going to give some brief opening thoughts on each version. Personally, from my standpoint, the 59 version obviously succeeds better. That's not to say the 2016 version doesn't try to improve on some things in terms of taking out, I would say, some of the campier elements that are there, but at the same time, the 2016 version looks a little cheaper because of the abundance of CGI. The acting's not nearly as up to par. There's not that sense of grandiosity to it. This very much feels like it's trying to please all comers, both the millennials and the religious people and the kind of casual film buff that might just stumble into this. That's not to say that I think the 16 version is the worst film that's ever come out this year. I think I've seen a lot worse. But the 59 version, I think, definitely succeeds more in what it sets out to do. Rick, what did you think about each version that we're discussing here today?
The 1959 version is unapologetic in its epic nature. It knows it's a grand epic story. It doesn't hide the fact. It goes for big and it goes for broke and it succeeds. Kind of just a hint here that director William Wyler, when he made Ben-Hur 59, said that's what he was going for. He wanted to see if he could make a Cecil B. DeMille film. And nothing Cecil B. DeMille made big, lavish, epic spectacles. With the 16 version, I think they tried to improve on what they thought were some of the flaws. I'm not sure that they succeeded. It was a little I don't want to say meandering, but it didn't have the epic nature of it. It felt overwhelmed with the CGI and with the fact that it wasn't epic. Ben-Hur 59, it's epic and it knows it. Ben-Hur 16 is not an epic and it doesn't know it. I'll put it that way.
I said the 16 version is the snake eating its tail. It wants to be a sequel or be a remake and not at the same time. And they're making a point of saying that the 2016 version is not based on the 59, that it's based more on the book. But having just seen both films, it's pretty much a copy or wants to be a copy of the 1959 Heston version. And you're right. It tries to be this epic, and I think what we've seen with a lot of movies that try to harken back to old Hollywood, there's an inability to convey what an epic means. So in this sense, with the new version of Ben-Hur, they assume, oh, people want to see that the chariot race looks real, but they do that by putting GoPros on the front of the chariot, so you get these weird out-of-place POV shots. While at the same time, the ship battle, when Ben-Hur is a galley slave, it looks fake. It looks like it's filmed on a blue screen. And a lot of the time they try to negate that by shooting through like a porthole. So you can't see what they're doing. And it just leaves you to think that you're watching a Mario Kart game. Like, are they racing? Are they fighting? I can't really tell. And when they do those big long shots, it doesn't really matter. The story ends up not being epic. You know, the 59 one that we've seen, it's a 3-hour and 40-minute movie, yes, but at the same time, it's trying to tell this epic story of a man who tries to play on both sides of the fence and ends up going through hell and back, finds Christ's redemption, which allows him to take a stand. And a lot of that plays into what was going on, again, as I mentioned in the intro, with McCarthy. And here, in the newer version, because we're trying to please an international market, we don't want to have that fence sitter type of character. So none of the characters have motivation or decision making skills. So like Ben-Hur is, I love everybody and I don't want to be involved in anything. And so when he becomes this galley slave, his actions are motivated by revenge, yes. But then once that's achieved, it really feels like the screenwriter just says, oh no, I forgot about Jesus in this movie. We gotta include him. And it literally turns into PG-13 Passion of the Christ. And Ben-Hur's catharsis means nothing. And we'll talk about how the ending completely ruins any type of resolution.
In more ways than one. In more ways than one.
Let's, I guess, break it down into some bite-sized chunks. Let's talk about the story. The 59 one is 3 hours and 40 minutes. This new version was originally touted as 2 hours and 30 minutes. And I think it's actually 203, 2 hours and 3 minutes. So I'm thinking at the 11th hour, they literally cut out, you know, another 30 minutes of story. What did you think in terms of what the 2016 version cut? They didn't really necessarily add, they just took away.
It's difficult because, again, having seen the 59 version, I have a different story that I remember.
If you're like me and you watched the new one first, so you were able to see what was lost.
They cut out two important characters. The most important one, which you got to see a little bit, the 16 version, Quintus Arius, who is the captain of the slave ship. And they cut him out. And that cut out an important segue to get Ben-Hur back to Judea to have this epic battle with his former friend and now fierce rival, Masala, because that's how he trained. And it kind of forced poor Morgan Freeman to become the de facto coach. And I never understood why they did that. They also cut out Balzar, who was one of the three wise men. That was a way for Ben-Hur to have that kind of religious connection, because the whole point of Balthazar is to find Christ again after he had given his gift at the birth of Christ. I don't want to say they cut Christ of the 16 version, but he was kind of a I want to say a guest star in this in the story that's supposed to be a tale of the Christ. So that was something that I was a little perturbed by, especially since this film keeps getting touted as toward the evangelical market. And I'm thinking, well, how is it part of the evangelical market when Christ kind of just pops in here, says some nice things, and then just disappears, and we don't really... He's not a threat. That was the thing in the 59. He was always popping up in important parts, but the 59 version doesn't show Christ. You don't see him, you don't hear him. One thing I will say about the 59 version, it's a very long film, but for most of it, I never felt that it was very long. I think it went by very fast.
You bring up a lot of good points. Buenos Aires in the 59 one allows Judah to not only come back to Judea and be placed next to Messala again, he also gives him the clout. Judah goes to the galley ships as a slave, but ends up working with Quintus Arius and becomes this big charioteer and ends up making money and going back to that status of wealth. With this new one, he comes back and remains a slave and doesn't really get that ability to be on equal footing. It just becomes this kind of, to throw in another Bible story, a David and Goliath type of thing where he's the former prince turned slave against this son of Rome. It lowers the stakes a lot. The 2016 version, they say that Judah Ben-Hur is a prince. That means nothing in this movie. It's literally almost like a figurehead position. We don't see him having subjects or doing anything. Like, he mentions talking to some people, but you're never really given any indication that he has any power or clout in that regard. And the fact that he's Jewish, especially in 59 version with regards to Jesus, that should mean something. In the 2016 version, it literally means nothing. Even though we want you to say that if you're not Christian, in the case of Messala, who everybody berates for believing in pagan gods, that means something, but not the fact that, you know, Judah is a Jewish prince or anything like that. You have some issues there. The overall message, too, being in the 59 version, you know, about having a stand and believing in something, and this doesn't have that. One of the changes that I thought the 16 version did for the better is the introduction of conflict, which is there. Messala goes to Judah and tells him that, I called it, that they're having a Pontius Pilate Pride Day, where Pontius Pilate's going to go through the streets, and Messala wants to make sure that nothing bad's going to happen. Well, at the same time, there's this third group of people called the Zealots. We're never really sure what their agenda is other than causing trouble and saying that Rome is wrong. And they don't really have a big significant presence, or if any, if I can recall, in the 59 version. They just kind of seem to be there because this is produced by Christian producers as a means of showing, you know, what happens when you're, I don't know, an atheist or something. Although, so there's this parade going through the city. In the 59 version, Judah's sister Tirza is leaning over the balcony, and because I guess Jesus, despite being a carpenter, didn't fix their roof that day, she knocks over some tiles, which ends up bonking the Roman governor on the head. And that's enough to make them think that the house of her is filled with governor killers, I guess. The logic's a little skewed here. In this 2016 version, there's an injured boy who's a member of the group that Judah has been caring for, and he decides, with no concern for the people that have housed him this time, takes an arrow or a bow and arrow off the wall and shoots at Pontius Pilate. And because Judah's housing him, they assume that he is in on this whole assassination attempt. That, I felt, worked better than it does in the 59 version. I thought the whole tile falling was a bit silly. Mind you, when we see this guy who has caused Judah to go through hell, again, he's just sitting in the arena at the chariot race watching, and nothing bad happens to him. You know, hey, that looks like the guy I screwed over by trying to kill Pontius Pilate. I don't ever know what happened to him or his family, but, you know, I'm just gonna watch this. So I thought that at least, was a bit more believable. But I don't know how I would have felt had I seen the 59 version before.
I think because I saw the 59 version more, I'm still with the tiles. I still like the tile falling. This whole thing with Arrow, I'm sorry, when I did hear that line about, you know, who shot the arrow? I wanted to just jump up and say, I said Cock Robin, I shot the sparrow with my bow and arrow. I wanted to shout that.
Just struck me. Let's talk about our actors here. You have Charlton Heston and Jack Houston playing Judah, and then you have Stephen Boyd and Toby Kebbell playing Masala. We know that the bromance between Masala and Judah is not nearly as filled with homoerotic overtones as is in the 59 version. Now, you and I are at odds on that point, because I feel that the 59 version, the bromance, I think, is very easy to see if you're open to it, because I saw it right away with the way Stephen Boyd looks at him and tells Heston about, you know, unrequited love. And so I definitely think there's a bromance in the 59 one. In the 2016 version, that's all very muted, aside from the fact that Jack Houston's just very touchy-feely.
I am very naive and innocent, because in the 59 version, and I saw it again, I think you can read that. You could see it if you look for it, or if you think that there is, there could be. I didn't see it. So that's the great thing about the 59 version. If you want to see some sort of gay undertone, like, you know, Masala's passion out Judah and Judah isn't, you could see that. But if you don't see it, then, you know, it's not there. It's just two very close friends who've had a falling out.
You can also say that about the religious angle as well. If you watch the 59 version and you don't... Obviously, Jesus is hard to ignore. That's definitely Jesus Christ. But the rest of the moments of faith are almost there as kind of breadcrumbs for people who are Catholic. Who had mentioned the Sermon on the Mount. And if you didn't really know that was what was going on, you would just think that, like, Judah stumbled upon a bunch of people talking on a hill.
It was more, I don't know if subtle is the right word, but it wasn't as overt as it could have been, I think, in the 25 version it was more overt. In the 16 version, I don't know, they say it was there, I didn't see it. But in the 59 version, I think it was more subtle. You don't really have this great, forgive the pun, come to Jesus moment. For a variety of reasons, you wanted to have a wider audience. It was almost I think people assumed in 1959 that most everyone knew the story of Christ or was more religious. I can't say for sure. I don't know if the fact that William Wyler was not Christian had anything to do with it, but I know that Wyler had a great line when he said that it took a Jew to make a good movie about Christ, and yes, it did. In the 2016 version, you have Roma Downey and Mark Burnett, who are trying to appeal more to the evangelical market. So maybe they were trying to. I don't think it worked. And I say this as an evangelical. So I wasn't quite convinced.
I love movies, I think, from the golden age of Hollywood that were religious, because they're really open to just the concept of having faith in something. It doesn't have to have a specific religion associated with it. It's more an emphasis of focusing on belief than anything else, which I appreciate. But let's talk about our actors here. So we started with Stephen Boyd versus Toby Kebbell. I think the role of Masala could be great for somebody who's kind of intimidating. Stephen Boyd, he was a bit of a pretty boy. He didn't really become an A-list star. And outside of the homoeroticism, because he takes such a breather in the middle of the movie, you don't really get a greater sense of who he is. Toby Kebbell, they try to give his character some history in terms of he was adopted at a young age by the Hurs, and his grandfather presumably killed Caesar, I guess. But Toby Kebbell doesn't have the acting chops to pull off that backstory. So he just kind of, everybody talks about how serious he is. The Ben-Hur's mom doesn't want him all, you know, hanging out with her daughter. There's not a whole lot for any of the actors to grasp onto, but certainly not enough for Toby Kebbell to act out somewhat of a more expanded backstory.
I think it was a terrible mistake to make Masala so sympathetic. I kept writing in my notes when I was watching Ben-Hur that why is he being bullied, basically. The mother Hur, as I said, Mother Hurd was mean to him. Like, nothing he did made her happy, and you think he's been living as her son of sorts all these years, and yet she's always going after him for something or other. I did not understand that. I think Toby Kebbell, in the 16 version, he was almost like the victim. I felt sorry for him a lot of time. You're supposed to cheer when he's defeated in the chariot race, but here's like, no, poor kid. He's an abused child. Yeah, what is this?
You're never really sure why Mom has kept him around, short of maybe Judah stepping in. I do think that the mom in the 59 version is fantastic. She's got such personality. You feel the anguish from her. It's a bit of a letdown that Ayelet Zurer, who plays the mom in this, doesn't have anything other than being, you know, upset. And you're right. I mean, making him sympathetic totally negates the ending, which we won't touch on right now, but I mean, the way that things end, that shouldn't necessarily be a happy ending.
No, and I'll say this so much about Stephen Boyd. You're right, he didn't become a big star. Despite being in this massive film, the only other film I can think of him in is in Jumbo with Doris Day. But then I love Doris Day. Other than that, I think this was one of his early roles, I think, coming out. So I don't know why. I think it's actually a pretty good villain, not a great villain, but he at least
he's a villain.
Had
he's a villain with purpose. You know, you need to have his character remain a villain in order for Judah's redemption, for him to realize, hey, you know, hate's not the way I gotta go here. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, because we want to talk about the ending a bit more in depth. Let's talk about our Judas. We have Charlton Heston versus Jack Houston, and everybody knows two things about me. I don't like Charlton Heston as an actor, and I love...
I forgive you.
And I love Jack Houston. But Charlton Heston, as much as I don't care for him, and I always think he's playing Charlton Heston in a movie, which is no different here. He's essentially playing Taylor from Planet of the Apes. You know, the characters, I think, are rather interchangeable, because Heston really only has one Mose, which is growly and angry and half-naked. But that's required here, because the characters tell him, you know, hate fills your heart, you know, it keeps you alive. And you need that. You need a character like Heston, even though no one has the right accents, and Heston's American, even though they're in Judea, and Stephen Boyd's English, which is no different in the 2016 version, because Jack Houston and Toby Kebbell are both English. But you need that hate fire fueling Heston's character, which is why the ending works so well in the 59 version, because he realizes, hey, hate's gotten me alive, but it's not going to sustain me in my life. It's not going to make my life worth living. With Jack Houston, the script gives him nothing other than, let's show people why you should be a Disney prince. So we get like a lot of scenes of him with horses, taking care of horses, riding horses. What is this have to do with anything? Nothing. Isn't it great that Jack Houston looks so adorable with a horse? And when he becomes a galley slave, there's nothing there for him to do. You know, even the scenes with his wife, Esther, played by Nazan Aboniadi, there's nothing except for the fact that they love each other because he's hot and she's hot. And I think part of that is the script, and the fact that Jack Houston's never really been a leading man, especially in a big movie of this kind. He originally auditioned for Masala, which I think would have played more to his strengths, because you need somebody kind of fueled by an inner torment. And Jack Houston's just kind of ambivalent about everything for most of the movie.
Well, that's an interesting point that I didn't think about before, that he auditioned for Masala. I think he would have been much better, but I will say this about Heston. I love Charlton. I love Chuck. But you're right. He sometimes can do the same over and over again. I'll say this. A film like this, an epic thing else, had right. that epic where he dominates and you're going to take charge and he's going to fighting. That's the interesting thing. It's story-wise, and I hope I'm not kidding myself, in the 59 version, it was not alive all those years as a galley slave because of his hatred. In the 16 version, I think they said it was faith that kept him. I'm going, well, I don't remember, but I'm going, no, I'm not quite sure that's accurate. Or at least it didn't it play that way.
And it's a very broad term to cover up the fact that there's not a lot of emotion in his performance.
Well, you know, I'll say this about Jack Huston. You know, bless his heart, he's very pretty in the film.
I'll agree with you on that.
I'm not taking that away from him. But the script really, I don't think the script gave anyone.
Yeah.
I think you could have cast any good actor in, assuming his 30s. I don't think they would have been able to have done much with the character of Judah as he was written for the 60s version.
I agree.
For the 59 version, kind of, just to mention this real quick, Charlton Heston was not the first choice. He was kind of at the end of it.
The saddest thing I think they could have improved on is the character of Esther, because in the 59 version, Haya Harit, who ended up playing Helen of Troy in another movie about that time period, she's beautiful, but she is got no personality. I mean, she's better integrated in the story than in the 2016 version. She's visiting Judah's family and supplying them with food, and she's really a big player in bridging the gap between Judah and Jesus. In the 16 version, Nazanin Boniadi, I think, is a better actress than Haya Harit, but she has nothing to do other than look pretty and stand around and wait in corners and either cry or whisper. You know, she's got nothing to go with, and I think that would have been really great to improve the females in this movie, but the 16 version just doesn't care about giving anybody a character.
No, and that's the thing between the 59 and the 16 version when it comes to Esther's character. If you notice the scenes between Heston and Harareet, they evolved slowly. The relationship grew, and you got to see them fall in love, and they played it. With the version in voiceover, which I despise, Jack Huston just runs off after the slave that we see just for a few moments, and, oh, I'm in love with you, marry me. And that's it. Okay, I'll just take it on faith that you have loved afar all these years, because we've never actually seen you interact or
with
Esther.
They got a little odd flirting when he's in his Technicolor Dreamcoat party. I will say that there was always going to be kind of an issue with how that relationship played out for two different ways. In the 59 version, Esther is the slave daughter of his
Simonides.
Who I guess is like his slave butler. So Judah gives Esther her freedom as a wedding present. And then they kind of have that falling in love moment, which I was kind of afraid that he was going to be like, look, you're a slave. I gave you my freedom. You should marry me. That doesn't happen, thank goodness. But you're right, it does build, and there's really no indication outside of the ending that these two are actually going to get together. It's a very platonic relationship of equals, almost. Whereas in the 2016 version, we don't really remove the concept of whether she's a slave. He says that they can't be together because she's lower than him, because she is a slave. And yet, when she's sent off to get married, there's no talk of freedom, there's no talk of anything, so when he shows up, I was like, well, thank God he's a nice guy and he's attractive, because I'm pretty sure she wouldn't have had a choice in marrying him, because he's elevated in terms of position. But they actually, you're right, it's a voiceover, and then they cut to, well, we've been married for a long, long time, and I was kind of like, wait, how much time has passed? And that was actually an 11th hour save, because they knew that there was a sex scene in the movie later on, and supposedly that was actually a scene in the movie. In the finished cut, it's just them kind of lying there. But Jack Huston said that they had to include some type of way to say that they had gotten married so that they didn't irritate the evangelical Christians who felt that they were having premarital sex.
That is really interesting, and I don't know if a good number of the viewers would have even considered that they're not married at that time, because again, she's a slave. It's not like she would have much of an option on this. I don't know by this time they could have put in extra scenes where they show that they were in love, but in the 16 version it's like, oh, okay, well, guess what, I'm in love with you. And I'd be like, oh, okay, well, you know, you saved me from marrying one guy, so sure, I'll marry you. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Let's talk about the chariot race briefly. Which version do we think is better? Now, I think I do think that the 59, at least you can see everything. The 2016 version has a horrid tendency to rely on shaky cam as a means of saying it's more authentic. And that ends up making it very hard to see because there's a couple long shots, but it's mostly very confined or in weird, like, GoPro. Everything, there's a herky-jerky movement to everything. Whereas in the 59 version, it's framed beautifully. You get the requisite shots that evoke movement. You get to see the struggle, the inner torment of this race with Judah and Missala. The anguish, you know, and the fear that something could really happen. With the camera moving so frequently in the 2016 version, it just looks like a lot of movement, a lot of noise, and you're not really understanding what's happening.
It's just kind of ironic that they tried to make it more real in the 16 version, and they ended up making it more fake. Because in the 59 version, you couldn't rely on anything like that. Yes, you had some special effects, some matte paintings to make the arena larger and to have more people in it. But apart from that, you had to do everything camera. You couldn't really have a lot of tricks to it. You had to have stunt doubles. You had to have dummies. There's when you see a scene, one of the charioteers gets run over, that was a dummy. And it was so convincing that people actually wondered if that was a real person that had been killed in the chariot race. It didn't work here. One thing that in retrospect that I'm glad we can mention real quick is that I hate the fact that throughout the movie they kept teasing the chariot race. In the 16 version, you start with them about to do the chariot race and then you go back
in case you didn't know that they were going to be doing that eventually.
I hated that. And at least in the 59 version, that came not quite at the end, but near the end of the movie. So we didn't get this, wait for it. I hated that. And they teased it constantly, which drove me bonkers as I was watching the 16 version. The 59 version, I think both races are about the same length.
So, the 2016 version is actually longer. The 59 version clocks in at about 9 minutes. This one clocks in about 12 minutes.
The 59 version kept things more level. I don't remember seeing a lot of overhead shots or anything like that. You got to see everything pretty much at eye level. You would cut to the crowd every so often. But here in the 16 version, everything was jumbled and rushed. And I'm just going to take a real quick moment to plug the 1925 silent version. Race is maybe just a little bit better than the 59 version. So check that out if you ever can.
We've touched on it a little bit, but the role Jesus plays in both movies. In the 59 version, we never see his face. He's just the back of, you know, the back of the head. He's a presence. But we don't have a face to go with it. So that's kind of trying to please all comers, even though we know in the 59 version, Jesus still has blonde hair. So we're, I guess, led to imply that he's white, but whatever. But he's still kind of this figure, and that's why I bring up the fact that movies from this era evoke faith as opposed to an actual religion. So we don't have a Jesus that we can put a face towards who actually says stuff. It's more of a feeling and more of, if you want to read into the fact that it's Jesus, even though it's hard not to, he's espousing faith more than any type of rhetoric. 2016 version, he's got a face. He's played by Rodrigo Santoro, who you might remember from 300. He is very much full on Jesus. So not only does he do good deeds, he's also, you know, spouting things that sound like they belong in the Bible. Almost like it's almost tongue-in-cheek if I didn't know it was blindly serious. You know, you're waiting for him to walk on water at a certain point, or, you know, walk by Judah and be like, hey, here's some bread and some fish. I was making a bunch of it, you know. It's almost kind of, if you didn't know who Jesus Christ was, we gotta give you the high points. It's a little ridiculous, especially at the end when Judah just is kind of, you know, kicked to the back in favor of presenting the entire crucifixion. We watch Jesus carry the cross up the hill. We watch him hang there. And I think that that's why it's so important that Judah in the 59 one goes back and says, you know, forgive them, for they know not what they do, you know, Jesus' words on the cross, because Judah retains that, and it's a message that he feels he has to get out. Whereas in the 16 version, you just see Jack Houston and all these people, and Jesus is the one who says it. So it literally comes from the horse's mouth. It's putting that pin in the map that says this is a religious film. I think you mentioned at the beginning that you're not really sure what Judah's role is in all of this. You know, he's moved. I said in my review, he's moved because the audience knows he's supposed to be moved. Not because you feel that he's actually taking anything to heart.
We need just a little bit of background into the Jesus portrayal. This was tradition, starting from the stage productions of Ben-Hur, where General Wallace was concerned about the portrayal of Christ. So they said Christ will not appear on stage. He will just be a bright light on stage. In the silent version and in the 59 version, they kept with that tradition. And Wyler also said in the 59 version that that was a conscious choice. You only felt Christ's presence. You only sensed what he was. And the audience would be clued in. Wyler trusted the audience to get it. Starting in the 2010 miniseries, I think that's when they started portraying Christ and hearing him and you saw him. With this version, you're right. He just kind of said nice things that you would see in scripture. It's almost like if they, you know, took scripture and just put it in Christ's mouth. I will say this. I'm happy that they cast Latin actors as Christ, because we had this, and in the Bible miniseries, you also had a Hispanic actor. I think he was Portuguese or Brazilian. So I like the fact that they're going slightly more, shall I say, ethnic. They're getting away from the blonde, blue-eyed God. They're getting away from I Was a Teenage Jesus in Tab Hunter?
Like that.
I'm glad that they're, you know, we're getting more. Christ's role in the 16 version, I think maybe that was just, again, a way to appeal to the evangelical market. The 59 version, it's his presence. It's the sense that this is Christ. You know, this is God, but you put in your own interpretation. If you believe him to be God, or you believe him to be a prophet, or you believe him to be a holy man or a righteous man, or what, or just a man, however you like to portray him, that's your interpretation.
The ending, spoilers, if you don't want to know, just fast forward a couple of minutes. In the 59 version, Missala is injured in the chariot race, and in his dying words to Judah, you know, kind of ends dying bitterly, tells him
the race goes on.
Exactly, which is a very poignant way of ending things. For Judah, he realizes that yes, life goes on, and the race, life is already a rat race, so why, you know, extend it by it being hateful? And Missala dies. In the 2016 version, Missala is again injured, and I thought he was dead because they're dancing with his corpse out in the street.
I thought so too.
Dancing with his corpse in a way that kind of reminded me of the death of Gaddafi. It seemed like a very politically charged moment, but I don't know if they thought that. And I thought he was dead. Turns out he's not. He loses a leg. And Judah goes to him all contrite and tries to bury the hatchet. And Missala, I guess he's the Black Knight in Monty Python the Holy Grail, at least what I thought, because he's, you know, telling him, like, oh, I could still take you, and I just kept looking at my friend and thinking, is he gonna be like, oh, I'll bite your legs off, it's just a flesh wound. Judah tells him, you know, he can't hate anymore, and they have to move on, and there's bro hug, and Missala is welcomed back into the Hur family with open arms. The mom who got leprosy because of him, and, you know, he almost killed her, she forgives him. Tirza, who also got leprosy, but it's okay because Jesus' miracle rain cured them, totally thinks he's still hot and probably wants to, you know, hook up with him or something. And they all lived happily ever after. There's no talk about the race going on. There's nothing. Everybody is redeemed, and oh, I'm pretty sure that, I'm assuming we're never told that Missala is a Catholic now. Throw away those pagan gods, of course, or else nobody would want to be his friend. Letting Missala live is probably the most ridiculous point this movie makes. Because, A, he almost killed these people, didn't care whether they lived or died, but please let me be your friend again. You know, he's that kid on the schoolyard that he's put mud in your face and blackened your eyes and broke your nose, but can I still hang out with you over here because nobody else wants to hang out with me? No, that's not how this works. And also, you lose that element of the race goes on and the concept that you can't live your life with hate. And I understand wanting to have inclusion and accept everybody, but because of the way this movie turns into a Jesus parable at the end, you're almost feeling like Masala has had to convert, only we just didn't see the conversion.
I have my theory, and I think Masala lived. And that was to leave the door open for a sequel.
How dare you say that, good sir?
I'm being slightly facetious, but I can. I at the end of it, I went and talked to my friend who was with me, and is there going to be Ben-Hur to Damascus Road, and they're going to, with Paul, and starting the Gentiles? So I'm not serious, but I don't know why. This is a problem with the 16 ending. First off, it really just comes out of nowhere. Why is Masala, who's just filled with rage, just going to forgive Judah because Judah says, well, you know, I'm sorry. Masala didn't see the crucifixion. Masala didn't interact with Christ. Masala has no knowledge of this. He's still worshiping his Roman gods, which is a thing that got Mother Hur so angry at him constantly. Even though you would have thought that having been with him all these years, they would have taken him to Hebrew school. And secondly, it doesn't give anyone any real sense. I don't want to say closure, but it didn't make any sense to me for this reason. You had put these two women in prison. They got leprosy. They got healed, even though they, again, didn't interact with Jesus. So who knows how? At least in the 59 version, Mrs. Hur and Tirza were at the crucifixion. They saw Christ walking the pathway to Calvary. So they at least had some interaction with Jesus. After all the things that Masala had done to them, and considering how Mother Hur was just not very fond of him throughout the whole, you think, oh yeah, okay, I got 5 years of my life were wasted, but yay, you lost your leg. Hey, we're even. That didn't make
exactly.
any sense.
So let's wrap it up. Which version succeeds? The 59 version is the one to watch. I will say, if you have an interest in seeing how we've modernized it, I see a lot of movies in my career, and I didn't think this Ben-Hur was the worst movie I'd ever seen. It's not a good movie by any stretch, but it's got decent acting. You know, the performances, I think, even though the script lets everybody down, the acting's solid. That's about it. That's all I got. I do also, I agree, like the change in terms of how we start the catalyst here. Tiles don't, I know they work for Rick, they don't work for me. But the 59 version is a classic for a reason. It's an epic for a reason. It's got that scope in terms of narrative, in terms of cinematography, in terms of acting. I wouldn't say it's a movie that I would willingly watch again. It's like Gone with the Wind for me. You know, I'm glad I've seen it. I've crossed it off the list, but I wouldn't, you know, whip it out on a Sunday to watch. You can understand why Hollywood made so many movies in its wake and is desperate to remake it, and it shows what we keep failing to achieve. So it does, it's a great example of classic cinema, in my opinion, even though I don't think it's my favorite classic cinema. Rick, what version are you promoting?
I'm a champion of the 1959 version. At least the 1959 version knew what it was. It knew it was an epic. It knew it was a gigantic tale. I mean, it's a tale of the Christ. You go cheap when you talk about Christ. You're going to go big or you're going to go home. And they went big. I'm also going to say that for me, one of the greatest things about the 59 version, and I've said this several times, is Miklos Rocha's score. That captures not just the titanic nature, no pun intended, the titanic of the film, but you also have very soft, lovely love scene music where you know that there's romance between Esther and Judah. With the 16 version, it's just there. I don't know if it has a real purpose. I wasn't really convinced with the acting as much as you might be. I guess because I'm still a Heston defender and I'll always be one. The 59 version, it's an epic. And it knows an epic. And it treats its subject as this grand vision where these people's lives are touched by Christ in large ways and small. With the 16 version, even though Christ has lines and interacts with them, he really doesn't have a purpose. And the 59 is always going to be the standard of Ben-Hur. It's going to be the one that you should watch just because it's so big and massive and unapologetic about it.
Let me know which version of Ben-Hur you enjoy. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and I'll read them on the next episode. Rick, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure.
I appreciate you joining me again because this is take two. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, if they actually want to write to me, my email is raragon03@earthlink.net. My website is www.rickstexanreviews.com. My Twitter is @rxcafetx. I'm always willing to hear from people, good and bad.
That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com. You can also via Stitcher Radio or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter now at ticklish_biz. I'll be back next time with another guest talking about another amazing classic film. Until then...